everyone, and welcome to this evening's AAHKS webinar, A Case-Based Approach to Unicondylar Knee Arthroplasty. I'm Kevin Plancher, and I'd like you to take one moment to review all the webinar planner, presenter, and otherwise contributed disclosures. They can be found in your handout tab. The purpose of this symposium is to provide our members with an up-to-date information allowing for success when performing a unicompartmental knee arthroplasty. The presentation will be 60 minutes in length and will include a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question at any time during the web presentation, please select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Type your question, then click send, and the question will appear. I'd like to introduce at this time our moderator for today, with great distinction, Dr. Adolf V. Lombardi. Welcome, Dr. Lombardi. Please take it away.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Welcome to everyone listening this evening. We've got a packed program here for you. We are joined tonight by Andrew Freiberg, who's going to talk to us a little about how to do a successful medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty. William Duranik is going to address the lateral compartment and give us the tips and pearls. Mike Byrne will tell us what the literature has told us and what we've learned from the literature. And finally, Mike Bolognese will tell us about converting a partial knee to a total knee and what the intricacies of doing that just are. And then we'll have a Q&A session with some cases that I've selected. So I'm going to go ahead and bring up my first talk here. And the title of my presentation is Selecting the Proper Patient for Medial and Lateral Unicompartmental Knee Arthroplasty. My next slide is the excuse me for a minute. I'm sorry about that. So my disclosure slide, I do have a relationship with Zimmer Biomet, which is somewhat pertinent to this discussion. The real question in my mind is, when should I offer the patient a uni, and when should I offer the patient a total knee? And I have to decide, what is that patient's range of motion? What is the disease pattern? And I'm going to go through with you why you might select a uni over a total knee. It preserves the undamaged structures, therefore it's a minimally invasive technique, and it preserves the cruciate retaining or normal kinematics. The PFJ joint is also normal. There's better range of motion with a partial knee than with a total knee, and from some gait studies, we show that the function is better with a total knee. And invariably, if you have a patient who has a total knee on one side and a uni on the other side, they seem to prefer the uni, and we can really say that the pain relief is equivalent. If we looked at our database, Keith Barron and I, we looked at the relationship of the ACL. When we had an intact ACL, those patients we did a total knee on had worse postoperative scores, less improvement, and lower range of motion than those with a pre-existing ACL deficiency. Another reason why maybe preservation of ACL may explain the better results that are frequently observed in a unicompartmental knee arthroplasty. This slide shows you my personal experience in primary knee arthroplasty, and what you're seeing here as you look towards the last dozen or so years, my utilization of partial knee replacement has just incrementally increased to the point where I'm about over 30%, and in 2018, I'm probably nearing 40%. But I think the prevention of failure in unicompartmental knee arthroplasty is the proper indications. And so what are the indications? If we go back to the classic indications, these are the Cozen and Scott indications, it was pain at rest, less than 90 degrees, or flexion less than 90 degrees, flexion contracture greater than 15 degrees. All these were considered to be contraindication. And angular deformity greater than 15 degrees of valgus or 10 degrees of varus, chondrocalcinosis, age greater than 60 years of age, weight greater than 180 pounds, or extensively physically active patients or patients perform heavy labor, which really narrows it down to maybe 5% of the patients you see. But we have adopted the Newfield criteria. And in the Newfield criteria, this calls for full thickness anterior medial osteoarthritis. The anterior medial pattern, the intact ACL, a correctable deformity in a valgus stress x-ray. There's full thickness cartilage laterally, less than 15 degrees of contracture, less than 15 degrees of varus, and greater than 90 degrees range of motion is what we typically see. What's not contraindicated is significant patellofemoral disease, but when it comes to the lateral patellofemoral disease, that is, for me at least, a contraindication. But not chondrocalcinosis, obesity, age, activity. The contraindications really are inflammatory arthritis and post-HTO. Now, what happened recently in 2016 is that Keith Barron, not Mike, who's on the webinar tonight, got together with several other surgeons, including Dick Scott and John Noel Argenson, and these gentlemen had over 8,000 unicondylar arthroplasty experience, and they utilized anywhere from 10 to 50% of their practice. And so the consensus statement said the indications were anterior medial OA, secondary was avast necrosis, no longer considered contraindications were obesity, age, patellofemoral disease, or chondrocalcinosis. The contraindications were inflammatory disease, previous HTO, and ACL deficiency. And we can debate that one as well, maybe in our discussions. So what do we mean by anterior medial osteoarthritis? What we're talking about is this full-thickness cartilage loss medially. And if you look at the lateral x-ray, the bone is preserved posteriorly. When the bone is preserved posteriorly, we know the ACL is intact. And it's fully correctable on a stress view without any loss of the lateral joint space. So this is the typical radiographic analysis that I will perform. A standing AP, a PA flex. And the PA flex is very important because we know that lateral compartment disease is a disease of flexion. A good lateral, so I can look to see if that posterior bone is intact. A merchant view to assess the patellofemoral joint. And for me, the stress view, whether it's done with a leaded glove view or whether we do it by just having the patient lying supine and pressing on an object. But this is extremely important for me. And how do you do that? With the patient laying supine, the beam is angled at 10 degrees, the knee is flexed at 20 degrees, and then the leaded hand is used to apply the stress. What you'd like to see is a non-rotated view, 20 degrees of flexion to allow for that correction of deformity because the posterior capsule doesn't interfere. And that is a excellent stress view, clearly indicating a partial knee replacement. Again, I mentioned this fully intact ACL. When the posterior cortex is intact, the ACL is intact because when you lose the ACL, you start to erode the posterior bone. And according to White et al., in 2004, was actually more reliable than even an MRI. So you want to look at that lateral x-ray carefully. This is the typical resection that you'll perform when you're doing a uni. Note that the cartilage is intact posteriorly and the arthritis is anteriorly. So we're talking about full-thickness anterior medial osteoarthritis with a functionally intact ACL and normal valgus stress radiograph. Also, avast necrosis would be an indication. Now, this was done a membership survey of AAKUS in 2006, and you look here and you see that the 45-year-old active male, only 11% thought that they should have a uni when they had medial disease, and for the 45-year-old female, it was 29%. When they got to 60-year-olds, then we're in the 45 to 47%, and then it changes back in the older population, a 75-year-old back to 27%. Well, I would tell you that 75-year-old active male or female, they have less risk of morbidity and mortality with a uni. And to me, that's the operation of choice. And even for me and the younger patients, they seem to prefer the uni over an HTO. And again, we can have that discussion later on in the talk. This was a paper looking at what contraindications. So based on the Cozen and Scott, these patients actually would have been contraindicated if you go down this list here, but they actually did very well. So again, more credence to the Newfield criteria. Age less than 60, we reported this. There was no difference in our series. Obesity in our series that we also published with David Murray and Chris Dodd, BMI is not a factor. We've done patients with grade 3 and not have had revisions because of patellofemoral disease. What about the lateral uni? It's less than 1% of all the knee arthroplasties. It's technically more difficult. It's less reproducible. And you've got to worry about the screw home mechanism. The indications are isolated lateral osteoarthritis, maybe more common, and it's often missed if you don't get that PA flexed view. We like to see that it's we like to see that in the radiographic views that we have the medial disease pattern, and we do the stress view at 45 degrees, as you see here, to determine if there's collapse of that medial lateral compartment. So full thickness loss laterally, maintenance medially on the varus stress radiograph, no significant radiographic patellofemoral disease. So here's a basic X-ray standing view here. The PA flexed, again, and how important it is to get a PA flexed. The lateral X-ray and the merchant view. And here's the stress view being done, showing you the correction of the deformity. So my take-home message to you, and I think all of our take-home message tonight, is think about partial knee arthroplasty. Think about the indications for medial and lateral uni. I'm going to turn the meeting over to Andy Freiberg. He's going to take control now, and he will tell us what we need to know for a successful execution of a medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty. Andy, thank you.
Adolf, and thank you very much for that wonderful talk and for the introduction. Every time I listen to your lectures, I learn something. Can you see my slides okay, and are we up and ready to go?
We're good.
Okay. That's fantastic. So what Adolf has asked me to do is give some surgical tips for, I'm going to isolate it to fixed bearing medial unicondylar arthroplasty, and then after me will come Bill with the lateral side. Now, these are my disclosures, and they are also relevant as I've been involved in partial knee development for more than 15 years. I'm going to try to keep this to not any specific brand, and I think it will be helpful for any type, any device or any manufacturer's implant. The basic surgical goals of a medial unicondylar arthroplasty relate to alignment, to coverage and fixation, and to appropriate joint stability and laxity. And I'll review these in a little bit more detail in the few minutes that I have. I like to use long-axis films. I use an EOS machine for pre- and post-op radiographs, and that really enables me to get excellent views and maintain the alignment that I want. For a medial unicondylar arthroplasty, the goal is slight varus to neutral alignment, and on the lateral view, it's anatomic slope, which really means for a fixed bearing in the 5 to 7 degrees of posterior slope. And I'll be interested to hear in the mobile bearing what Adolf's comments might be related to that. The next issue is coverage. We want to optimize the anteromedial coverage, and I'll show you some intraoperative pictures. And the reason why the anteromedial coverage is so important is that's really what correlates with long-term stable fixation. So there's no subsidence, and really it's for long, stable fixation. Also, the anterior-posterior length of the implant should be optimized, but if I have a choice, I want to optimize my anteromedial coverage. This X-ray also shows that the vertical cut is made at the base of the ACL, and I'll show a little more detail with some technical tips. So I have 6 important technical tips for medial arthroplasty. I have 12 technical tips for total knee arthroplasty, but since we're only doing half, I thought I would stick to 6. Adequate exposure, a careful and proper tibial resection, don't overcut the posterior tibia, don't oversize the femoral implant, optimize the anteromedial tibial coverage, and as far as the articulation is concerned, it should be balanced and not too tight. So this schematic shows what it looks like to do the tibial resection. On this, the tibular section would be too large, but I thought it was a good picture to show the vertical cut at the base of the footprint of the ACL coming through any type of alignment guide or down to the cutting guide. You want to have the orientation of this relatively straight, and also don't turn the saw blade off of straight up and down. So you want to be perpendicular on this vertical resection. This is what it looks like intraoperatively. So what I like to do is I like to bring my tibial cutting guide in after my exposure, and I do a one centimeter mid-vastus split at the top of the femur. I think that's been a successful approach for me for a long time. They showed that. So I set my varus valgus in my slope. I bring my guide into about where I want to be, and then I like to use a small feeler to see where my vertical cut will be underneath the condyle. And then I check my rotation and position, and you can see it's a pretty straight cut. Well, here a little bit different from the lateral side, but this side, the medial side, is very straightforward as far as the vertical cut and the goes. So after I've brought it into about my correct position, I'll then use my depth gauge. For the system I'm using, I'll do about a 4 or 5 millimeter resection from the depth of the defect, unless it's severe. And then I'll do my vertical cut and remove my tibial piece. I then like to confirm my alignment and that I have full extension. I'm sorry, I skipped one slide. So I'll do my distal femoral cut in a linked way, which almost all of the modern systems use this spacer block method, and then confirm that I have full extension and proper alignment. Femoral sizing is next. There's a tendency to oversize the femoral implant. There really isn't much downside to having it a little bit small. You want to have a couple of millimeters around the implant before it gets into the tide mark and into the patellofemoral joint. And this is what an intraoperative on your left, it's too small. On the next, it's it could be this size or one size larger. But I'll comment that you want to remove any femoral osteophytes before you finish the femur so you don't end up oversized. And then after I finish the femoral implant, I like to reconfirm my extension and flexion gap so I can do any fine-tuning either to balance or bone resection as necessary. I then think it's easiest to do the tibial sizing at about 20 degrees of flexion. I use this small rake medially, and it allows, if you lift, to get excellent exposure. You can see straight posterior and onto the entire tibial surface. This is what I was talking about, optimizing tibial coverage. You want to have excellent anteromedial coverage and have it lined up. If there's a little bit of an osteophyte, I like to actually leave it there. It's a good shelf for cement removal. And then after I've cemented my pieces, I'll remove that, unless they're large, which you might need to do that for balancing. I then do a trial reduction, and I like to critically look at my extension, my mid-flexion, and my flexion stability. A couple of quick tips for cementing. I drill the surfaces after I place a little multimodal anesthetic posteriorly. I place a little cement under the tibial bone using an osteotome, actually. And then I put cement on the implant and put it in, touch it in the back first. Use an instrument to push it down and back first, and then just use my finger to push it down in front. I think most of us have gone away from using a mallet. This is controlled. There's really no risk of fracture, and frankly, it's easier. And then remove the cement, take a quick look, and remove cement from the back. As far as stability goes, just a comment. We can talk about this in the discussion section. You want to have a couple of millimeters of laxity with your trial in place. You don't want to over-tighten a medial uni. You want to be careful to prevent overcorrection, which is usually done by over-tightening. And I thought this would be a nice case to show because it leads into the lateral talk by Bill. So here's a patient that had overcorrection and at about 12 years went on to have lateral disease. And I think the question here is, should this be converted to a total knee or can you add a lateral uni? And for me, I converted it to a total knee replacement, and I think we'll have a chance to review that. So the summary is, as Adolf said, pick good candidates, make adequate exposure, use reliable instruments, don't overcorrect, never over-tighten the medial side, and use excellent, careful cement technique. Thanks so much for your attention. And now I will turn this over to Dr. William Jeronic, who will talk about technical tips for a lateral unicompartmental knee.
Dr. Jeronic, I'm sorry. Are you muted, Dr. Jeronic? We can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Great, Bill. Why don't you speak up? Thank you.
Can everyone hear me?
You're all set, Bill. Why don't you speak up? Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. So the incidence of lateral arthritis, about 20% of our knee arthritis. And if you look at the Paul Adolf's logic, about 10% of knee arthroplasties could be unis. About lateral would be about 10% of that number. So lateral unis between 1 and 2% of knee arthroplasties. I think the message is get good at medial unis first, but I think the lateral uni is a great operation. If you look in the literature, the survivorship of medial versus lateral unicondylars is just about this. This article from Vanderlift, who summated all of the both studies and registry data, and at 15 years survival. In the mid 80% range, which I think is reasonably good. The indications for lateral uni is you heard full thickness loss laterally, osteonecrosis just in the lateral compartment, a stable knee in the AP plane, maintenance of medial cartilage is Adolf pointed, and no significant radiographic patellofemoral disease. The contraindications to my mind, rheumatoid arthritis, of course, failed ACO. And valgus deformity greater than 20 degrees. So I think it's a great operation to start in the more elderly patient who doesn't need a fairly morbid full knee replacement, just has lateral disease for 75, and the results can be fairly spectacular. I think it's pretty clear from what Adolf has said and what the literature shows that you should use a fixed bearing implant on the lateral side. The results of mobile bearing on the lateral side have not been good. Should you use a robot? I think that there's very little literature to guide us, and I wouldn't combine a new operation with a new technology. I would learn the concepts of lateral unicon first. So what are the facts of surgical technique? I think they are different than what Andy just reviewed on the medial side. The wear pattern on the posterior femur, not the distal femur and anterior tibia. The screw hole mechanism is different. The patella tracks more on the lateral condyle. The lateral condyle is smaller, therefore a smaller component. There's a larger tibial footprint. Due to the screw home mechanisms, so often you need a larger tibial component. And the lateral compartment is looser, as we all know, even with an intact ACL, and the wear is posterior, so there can be a tendency to overstuff. And I agree with Andy's last comment. We really don't do that, particularly on the lateral side. So what are my tips for a successful implantation? Approach medial lateral, respect hold incisions. I think if you feel more comfortable coming from the medial side, that's fine, but don't create a situation like you see in this picture. Basic idea is internally rotate the tibial component slightly and externally rotate the femoral component slightly, and that's due to the screw home mechanism in full extension. Downsize the femoral component, upsize the tibial component, and do not put the components in. So this is just an example of internally rotating the blue tibial trowel that you see here. Well, you try to see. My pointer's not working. But anyway, it should be slightly internally rotated. You externally rotate the femoral component. So I check the condylar track and flexion before you orient your femoral component. And you know from the screw hole mechanism that the valgus angle increases, and you have to be careful or your femoral component will ride up on your intercondylar eminence. So usually say if it looks wrong, it's right. The x-ray of the femoral component and with the X shows that it's rotated about the way you would think it should go on the condyle, and you can see it's tracking way over the lateral side of the tibial tray. We want to avoid that. The tibial component tends to be larger because you're internally rotating, and also the tibial wear pattern increases the size of the lateral tibial plateau. The lateral femoral condyle, as you see in the slide on the right, is smaller than the medial condyle, so the femoral component is often a size lower by experience. So in conclusion, if you're good at medial unit, you should consider lateral because you really do very well. Isolated lateral compartment are more common than you think, and think about it in the older patient. It's worth traveling to watch somebody who does them. Through home motion in your component positioning. Femoral component tends to be smaller, component tends to be larger. Lateral compartment is looser to stuff. And with that, thank you very much for your attention. And I'm turning it over to Mike.
Thanks, Bill. Adolph has charged me with talking about how successful are partial knee replacements, and I'd love to use really a 20 or 30 year literature review to go over how successful partial knees can be. Relative to this talk, I have developed both medial and lateral unis with Zimmer Biomet, and so please keep that bias in mind. I'd like to cover six topics and go over what the literature says about revision rates, outcome and function, range of motion, patient-reported outcome measures. I think that's becoming more important for all of us. Complications and things that we all deal with, both in the acute time period, some medical and some related to the knee, and then in the long term as well, including mortality, and then talk about the durability of the implant. So that I think these are the important factors to consider when you're choosing a uni versus a total for the right indications, as Adolph went over. And I think the key thing I've realized is perhaps not all of our total knees are doing as well as we thought. So for me, over the last 20 years, why more partial knees, or why is the percentage of partial knees in my practice increased? I think it's a better understanding of indications and patient selection. As Adolph mentioned, and there's abundant data that when you keep two-thirds of a normal knee, there's better function. Every series registry and ours and other multi-center studies show low repair operative risk. There's higher patient satisfaction in blinded studies, fewer residual symptoms, and then for us, it's been the gateway for the outpatient program. So we've concluded less is more for the patient. So for us, our whole practice has become a compartmentalist, both medial and lateral and patellofemoral joint, and not all patients with osteoarthritis need a total knee replacement. As I've begun to understand the indications and got more facile with procedure, partial knees have increased from 6% to now over 40 to 50% year on year for the last 10 years in our practice. So the first thing to consider is primary outcome measure, which is revision of the knee. I think this is the main critique against partial knee replacements, that the registry data shows head-to-head comparison of total knee to partial knee, there's roughly a 3 times increased risk of revision when comparing partial to total over the first decade. And that would suggest that partial knees have more poor results leading to the revision, and therefore we should stop doing partial knees purely based on the fact that the revision rate is higher. And I think it's something to question whether this is a justified conclusion. And then also to consider exactly, is this the best definition of failure revision in the registries? We've asked the question, does revision equal failure? Certainly in a case like this with 6 months post-medial uni with overstuffing in the medial compartment and a fixed bearing design, lateral progression would be failure necessitating revision. Loosening of the implants, infection, bearing dislocation with mobile bearing devices, polyethylene wear, or dissociation from the metallic tibial implant can be problems. But I think if you have a broader understanding of failure, including patient dissatisfaction, residual pain, recurrent effusions, loss of range of motion, radiolucencies that we don't understand, was the partial knee indicated to begin with, I think you begin to understand there's a significant bias towards the threshold for revision being much lower for a partial knee than for a total knee. So the New Zealand registry has both outcome measure of the Oxford knee score at 6 months. And the question is whether partials have more poor results. And the mean difference between partial knees and total knees at 6 months, it's 2 points higher for the partial knee, 39 to 37. More partial knees have an Oxford knee score over 41 or an excellent outcome than total knees, and there's less poor results compared to a total knee replacement at 1.5 times rate. So there's some difference in revision rate not being due to the outcome measures. If you graph it out, looking at the percentage of patients that get a revision based on an individual Oxford knee score, you see for each functional outcome measure of the OKS, there's a 5 times higher likelihood that a partial knee would be revised compared to a total knee. And so I think the revision threshold for a dissatisfied patient is significantly different for a partial knee and for a total knee. So I think the UK is certainly much easier to revise. You look at the cementless partial knee on the right. If that patient was dissatisfied, had pain, I think most of us would work it up and then likely to revise that much more so than a well-fixed, you know, primary total knee that's well-aligned, doesn't have an indication for revision as you see on the right. And so despite fewer poor results, partial knees continue to have a higher revision rate compared to partial knees. If you look at the patient outcome measures in a subset of partial knees versus total knees from the National Joint Registry from the UK, and you look at their outcome measures, you can see here in the histogram significantly higher outcomes, more excellent results for partials in green, and fewer poor results as you can see in red. So fair and poor, better. Our very best unis are doing better than our very best total knees. And a poorly functioning total knee, you can see here roughly 30% of patients would rate their total knee outcome as poor, and that's the elusive 20% that we're all trying to understand and improve the outcome. We did a multi-center study looking at early 90-day complications between partial and total knee. And humbly, if you look at this data directly, you'd say we should stop doing total knee replacements because the acute complication rate is 3 times higher with a total knee compared to a partial knee. If you look at large series, over 100,000 matched patients from the NJR in the UK, there's a low occurrence of every complication, readmission, and mortality. If you look at this data set with 20 variables equally matching the scores for pre-op characteristics, you can see length of stay less, readmission, intraoperative complications, transfusion, everything that us and our patients are worried about, much lower complications as published in Lancet. So it's a safer operation for our patients. Well, certainly mortality is a humbling thing as a surgeon. In both the 30-day and 90-day mortality ratios are half for partial knee compared to total knee, and then this continues on to the 8-year point. So if you use 100 unis instead of total knees, there's one less death, but 3 more revisions over the 8-year period. So a safer operation. And then there's abundant survivorship, not only in designers' hands, but Ulf Svart, I think, has done the lion's share with 400 unis, long-term follow-up, now out to 20 years, 94% survivorship. And this is an incredible series where no patients were lost at follow-up. And if you look at the reason for revision, at least with the mobile bearing device, no indication for revision for polywear. And the patients always ask, how long do these last? And you can see for lateral progression, it's less than 2% at 20 years. So as patients ask me, what's the durability of the knee? I think with confidence we can say the likelihood of reoperation on your knee in my hands is equal between partial and total knee replacement. It's a safer operation with equal durability. And I think with that philosophy, half of our patients now qualify for partial knee replacement. Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll turn it over to Bolo now to talk about the rare case of revision.
Thanks very much, Mike. This will lead in nicely, and I'll get going here. My disclosures are on the next slide, and nothing pertinent to partial knee arthroplasty. I apologize that these slides were left in just from a previous version of my talk, but it does give me a moment just to let you know that we've had a tough time with some flooding here in North Carolina. But I had meant to drop that, but think of my neighbors at the coast as you're hearing this session tonight. Well, I think we know, we heard all about the benefits, if you will, of partial knee arthroplasty. And even though we're using more, I think we still would have to say whether the indication for revision or conversion was appropriate. They are on the rise. We've seen that in some series. And I'm going to touch on these points as we go through this talk in an effort to get us to our cases to review here in a minute. But there's some just simple concepts we should think about when converting. I apologize that these are sort of covered up some of the wording. I'm not. Some of this should be popping up. But basically, I think it's really important, as Mike touched on, you really don't want to go into revising a total knee if it's just painful for no obvious cause. And the same thing should be held true for a partial. I'd agree with Mike. But there are some reasons why you do have to revise them. And again, for some reason, these images are covering up some of the indications. But these were basically the indications that Mike had at the top of one of his slides. These were the things like infection, wear, instability, progression of disease, and I had some pictures just depicting some of those. Don't forget about infection when you get to the point that you're considering doing one of these operations. You've got to have a plan just like you would for a total knee arthroplasty evaluation. There's some discrepancy about the numbers that are out there, but I think it's the same test we would always use. What's behind this is revising a UKA to a UKA is basically probably something you shouldn't do. And the point of that is, unless it's just a bearing switch for one of the mobile bearing devices or true wear with well-fixed components, that's not something that you want to consider. That picture was to show you the bad idea that one of my patients had about getting a tattoo on the front of his knee of the knee implant we placed. The point I wanted to show here with these pictures is just that you have to consider bone loss. And the bone loss when you're simply doing these operations, obviously, are, here on the posterior medial femoral condyle and here also on the tibia. And so in these areas are where you're going to be thinking about bone loss issues. There's plenty of info out there, just like there is for partial knee survivorship, about conversion of partial knees to total knees and things that you can see from the standpoint of survivorship and implants required and complications experienced. And we'll get really simple here. Basically, you're going to make your distal femoral cut, and you can think about the operation differently if you're anterior referencing or posterior referencing. If you're anterior referencing, you might make the cut first, reference anteriorly, and then sort of assess the distal femur as you would normally. And again, apologize for these pictures just sitting in the way of my words. They're supposed to sort of populate as I advance the slide. Basically, the points here, again, was just to now talk about posterior referencing. You make your distal femoral resection, a partial resection on the medial side. Once you've done that, you can remove the femoral implant. And again, don't forget, most importantly, is that you're dealing with bone loss here. And so that will affect what you do with rotation of the implant and potentially elevation of the joint line. So you have to understand that there's all that posterior bone missing on the posterior medial femoral condyle. This was about the tibial resection, and these were some images to show you sort of what you deal with. I would recommend referencing the lateral side with your stylus. If you need an augment, those can be placed with either a hands-free approach or jigs. But I would say that certainly reference the lateral side, disregard the fact that there's a medial implant. In fact, I'd probably remove it and then try to create that stable tibial platform. Size your tibial component, and as I mentioned, you can do these augment preps freehand or with the guides, and they don't have to be augments purchased from the vendor. These can certainly be augments or screws with cement. Here's a couple of depictions of both approaches, and I think those folks that have provided these images, but certainly an augment can be used or a screw and cement technique. So a problematic partial knee should be approached in the simple, similar fashion as a problematic total knee. And again, I'd stress to you, like Mike Barron said, perhaps you should be really careful about converting those painful partial knees that you don't have an explanation for. They may be knees that get you just in trouble, like the painful total knee that you wouldn't mess with. You can do it. Think about bone loss and what you need to do about respecting rotation of the implants and certainly addressing things like alignment that may be affected by the bone defects present. Augments can be whether from the vendor or certainly, again, screws with cement. Thanks so much, and I apologize for some of those images being in the way of some of my words that were written there, but hopefully I got all the key points across. Thanks.
Okay, that was great. I'm happy that all of my presenters stayed on time and left us with some time now to go ahead and answer any questions. Kevin, are there any questions in the chat room?
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt. Maybe I'll just refresh our attendees' memories about how to ask their questions, if that's all right.
Sure.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin our question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please go to the chat box located in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question, then click the send button. And now I will turn the presentation back to Dr. Lombardi.
Okay, thank you. Well, we'll start with some case examples that I've put together and try to get the opinion from our illustrious faculty as to how they would approach these. Again, my disclosures haven't changed since my last presentation. So here is a patient who's 74-year-old male. BMI is 26. Right knee pain giving way, worse with activity. Was liked to run, but has had to stop doing that. Has had this pain for several years. He actually localizes his pain to the medial side, and he's a light laborer. He's had anti-inflammatory medications and arthroscopy and injections. So he has had some conservative treatment, no effusion, no limp. Range of motion is 0 to 125. No flexion contracture. Alignment about 4 degrees of varus, and no significant AP or ML instability. This is presenting AP X-ray. I'll ask Mike Barron, do you have to see bone-on-bone on this AP X-ray?
Not so much on this one. We get the same four views that everyone's mentioned, a PA scanning, a PA flex, and then sunrise view, and then the lateral. And you can see here the defect shows the cruciate's intact, and I'd love to see the PA flex and then the valgus stress X-ray.
Well, I have this standing AP. You get long alignment films, Dr. Jaranik, on everyone.
I do. I think they help me plan, so yes.
Anyone else get long alignment films? I don't.
Hello, I do.
So here's my varus and valgus stress views. And I elected to do the varus stress view here because I didn't have the PA flexed. And I wanted to document that there was indeed a collapse of that medial compartment. Having done that, if we can go to the questions and poll the audience, we want to know what the treatment options are. We go to the poll then. Next. No, not that question. Well, we'll do that one since it's up. If we do a unique, do you prefer a medial or a fixed bearing?
So while we're waiting, Dr. Lombardi, there's a question from the audience. With the patient with the occasional gout attack, would you advise doing a uni or not in an otherwise good knee?
Dranik, would you like to take that one?
Of course, Adolf. Thank you very much. No, obviously, if the knee is not very arthritic, he has recurrent gout, I'd treat the gout and not put any metal in it. Obviously, if he has significant cartilage loss just in one compartment, consider a uni after I treated the gout medically.
Okay, I would agree with that. So it looks like from our survey, about 61% of the responders choose a fixed bearing and 38% choose a mobile bearing. Could you now bring up the previous question, question number 9? And while we're waiting on question number 9, my question is, we'll go ahead and we'll see that there. So we can begin to answer that. Does anyone of the faculty perform a high tibial osteotomy and when? Polo?
Adolf, I do not perform them, we do have sports faculty that would do them, probably in a younger patient, but maybe a similar deformity or extended disease.
Okay. So we see from the response that 85% would do a medial uni and 14% would do a total knee. Andy, why do you think a total knee in this case?
Well, I think, Adolf, you know, you tip the conversation into a discussion about light labor, 200 pounds, and basically you're describing me. So I like the idea of a partial knee for me, but I think there are some surgeons who are more comfortable with the sort of perceived difference in durability of a total knee in this setting. And I think that's really what some people just don't do partial knees. But for me, this patient's a great candidate for a partial knee.
Mm-hmm. Does the patellofemoral articulation bother any of you?
No, it looks like a bipartite patella or a little piece. But actually, I think it looks perfectly acceptable. Now, I might rondure a little piece of something if I see it on the edge, but a deepened patellofemoral group doesn't bother me. I think there's still really good preservation of joint space there.
Mike, any comments on the patellofemoral articulation here?
No, I think it's got the characteristic osteophytes medially and laterally. You see that all the time. I think we removed those during the procedure, and the bipartite patella has been there 74 years and will be fine for the future. This looks excellent.
So now you can see I did a mobile bearing partial knee replacement, and I was very happy with the way the x-rays turned out, and the patient is very satisfied with the procedure. So I thought that I was full in on this being a appropriate indication. Let's look at the next patient, 52-year-old female, complains of bilateral knee pain, grading, giving way, right greater than left. She had an osteochondral defect lesion and a medial plica surgery. She works in a factory, her pivots all day long. She has a satisfactory range of motion, no instability, and she does have some medial joint line tenderness. These are her presenting x-rays, so here's her AP, her lateral, her merchant view with a little bling on there on her stocking. Dr. Bolognese, you want any other studies?
No, I mean, I think I'd be comfortable making a decision. I mean, I guess somebody might consider, you know, MRI or something like that. But
all right, so let's go to my next polling question. for this case. Thank you, Sandra. And so with this history, would you order an MRI? Dr. Bolognese mentioned that. Let's see what our viewers think. So as we're waiting for that, so Bolo, you don't need an MRI. What are your thoughts on that case?
Well, this is, I think, a little tougher one for me. I think if I was going to proceed to, operative intervention, this is one where I would have, you know, a total and partial knee available. And for me, I was a little worried about what I thought I saw quickly on your sunrise view with regard to patellofemoral articulation. I'm sure there'll be different opinions about that. If failed conservative treatment, I'd have both devices available.
Okay, so 64% say they don't need a MRI, and 35% of our participants said they would. So, but let me go back to that. What you wanted the sunrise view? Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, I thought you had one.
I did. I'm trying to get to that. 1 second.
Okay. Adolf, I think something's going on in the medial femoral condyle that the patellofemoral joint doesn't bother me too much.
All right. Well, here's the MRI. Something going on?
Yeah. Live dead bone right there. Live dead bone.
Okay. So is this too much dead bone, Mike?
I'm a little concerned about the location. I would proceed with the uni, and if I had good stability of the femoral implant, then I'd go ahead. If not, then I'd go to a total knee. This is one that the MRI occasionally overreads the extent of the disease.
All right, so let's go to the poll again and see what I've given the audience some suggestions here that we could think about doing. Non-operative management, and arthroscopy, maybe some chondroplasty or something, a medial UKA, and total knee arthroplasty. Now, while we're getting the responses here, what are your thoughts on subchondroplasty? Who would like to tell us a little bit about that? Kevin Planter, you probably know a little more about that than us. What do you think?
Good evening, Dr. Lombardi. So subchondroplasty, I have found effective, actually, for those with bony edema in the tibial plateau. And in a limited, concentrated area, not in diffuse. This has a large diffuse area of involvement, so I would not go for that as common.
Okay. Any other commentary on the subchondroplasty? Mike, have you used this technique?
No, I'm still trying to find the indication for it. You know, I sort of don't totally understand the bone marrow lesion edema with osteoarthritis being an indication. We've seen a number of failures of the subchondroplasty, and obviously I don't see the ones that work well, but I'm not sure we know, just because you get an MRI and it shows edema, that injecting something and drilling something in the plateau is the right treatment. So I'm sort of waiting for better data on that.
All right, so we've got a divided audience here. About 8% would do non-operative management. 8% would do some kind of arthroscopy, subchondroplasty. 50% want to do a uni, and 33% are going to do a total knee. I guess you kind of know what I did, right?
Well, not really.
Okay, let me take control back here and get my talk back up.
Adolf, one of my problems with the subchondroplasty is that it burns the bridge of a uni if that becomes sort of how the disease plays out. So I'm personally not a fan of that that treatment.
You think it burns it? How so? What do you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think I'm concerned about putting a uni onto an area that's had, you know, cement or other stuff injected into it like that and drilled. That would not be my first choice as far as support for a uni. So I've seen a few subchondroplasties go bad, and they've ended up in total knee because the quality of the bone and the collapse was more than I would at all be comfortable with.
Okay, fair enough. So this is a 50-year-old male.
Dr. Lombardi, I just want to show the audience, dude, there is a question for you. For a medial uni, do you ignore the patellofemoral joint? Do you ignore or do you avoid a KL grade greater than 2 for a patellofemoral joint? Carl was interested in knowing what the panel thought.
All right, I will answer for myself. If it's lateral facet disease, I get a little nervous. I've done a lot of grade 3s and even in the medial compartment and not been sorry that I did them. And I think we've not revised or added a patellofemoral to our medial unis. I would ask Mike Byrne, chip in.
Yeah, I would totally agree. I think there's two great studies by David Beard, back-to-back articles in the British Journal that answer this question definitively. It looks at the X-ray appearance of the patellofemoral joint, the intraoperative appearance of the patellofemoral joint, and then the outcome of the partial knee replacement, including pain relief and revision. And it has no correlation for trochlear or medial facet disease. Keith and Adolf and David Murray repeated that study with the U.S. population and found the exact same thing. So with trochlear or medial-sided disease, we also haven't added any patellofemoral problems over the last 15 years.
Now, in fairness, Mike and I do mobile bearings. So, Andy, what do you think from a fixed bearing perspective?
I'm sorry, Adolf. Tell me what you're driving at. I mean, I don't think there's a big difference.
Is there a big difference, you think, on patellofemoral disease that you'll accept fixed versus mobile in a fixed bearing, for example? Because a lot of the literature that we're quoting is mobile bearing.
Right. I mean, I think there is some data on the medial, but I think the data on the patellofemoral joint is a lot stronger on the mobile bearing, and that's the data that we look to right now. But our indications have been the same as far as accepting some medial disease. I think what gets confusing to me is the X-ray is one thing, but what happens when somebody has crepitus, and you know that kind of thing, or a little bit of anterior pain? My experience has been that accepting if they have a little bit of anterior medial pain or anterior patellar pain, if the X-ray doesn't look terrible, it usually gets better after the medial uni. But it's hard to know what to do with that. But I don't know. We've followed the mobile bearing indications in the fixed world, and so far that's been safe.
What about on the lateral side, Bill? What do you think?
Well, I think lateral or medial side, my criteria for not any bipolar changes, if you have poor wear, you know, bone, exposed bone on both the patella and the trochlear groove in a certain area, that's usually, for me, going to be a problem. I've built a few of them, but I think it's the way I would avoid it. And obviously, there are a certain amount of lateral facet arthritis where I don't think you can do a lateral uni and have it. I usually approach all the lateral approach, and so the pressure on the side of the patella is decreased, but I still wouldn't accept hibernated bone on both sides.
All right. Well, I think we're sort of close to the wrap-up time here.
We are, Adolf. I want to thank you. So on behalf of AAHKS and our speakers and this wonderful panel, we'd like to thank you for joining us this evening. At this time, I think you'll see an evaluation posted on your screen. Please take a moment to complete the form, and we sure appreciate your feedback. And this concludes this evening's webinar, and have a wonderful evening.
Thanks to the great faculty. Appreciate it.